Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Joseph Pache. This hour, we focus on criminal justice reform. America is home to the world's largest prison population. The U.S. incarcerates nearly 25% of the world's prisoners, despite accounting for less than 5% of its population. On the national stage, criminal justice reform is currently receiving a lot of attention from both Republicans and Democrats. The bipartisan Cut 50 movement is responding to America's fourfold increase in prisoners in the last 40 years. Proponents of reform claim that too many Americans are being incarcerated for far too long, without real opportunities for rehabilitation, and rates of recidivism remain high. They argue that prison costs are spiraling and U.S. families are suffering, particularly in communities of color, where African Americans are nearly six times as likely as whites to be incarcerated. Although this topic draws support from both sides of the aisle, internal disagreement regarding solutions remain and opponents to the movement persist. Meanwhile, here in California, the state has looked to its own solutions, like realignment and sentencing reform for nonviolent offenses under Prop 47 to address prison overcrowding. Tonight, we discuss what's being done to address the issue of over-incarceration in the United States. What factors have contributed to our current levels of incarceration? How can we reduce our prison population? And how can outcomes from initiatives to reduce the prison population here in California inform both the national conversation and point the way to what still needs to be done here at home? Joining me here in the studio tonight to discuss these issues and more are Matt Haney. He's director of policy at Cut 50, a bipartisan effort dedicated to reducing U.S. jail and prison populations by 50% in the next 10 years. Matt is also a member of the San Francisco Unified School District Board of Education, where he focuses on ending the school-to-prison pipeline. Welcome, Matt.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We also are joined by Hadar Avaram. She is professor of law at UC College of Law, UC Hastings College of Law, and her latest book is Cheap on Crime, Recession-Era Politics and the Transformation of American Punishment. Welcome back to the program, Hadar.
Good evening. Thank you for having me.
And finally, we're joined by Chesa Boudin. He is deputy public defender with the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. He has published works on a range of legal and social issues, including the impact of parental incarceration on minors. Welcome, Chesa.
Thanks so much.
And as always, we invite you, our listeners, to join our conversation. We'll open our phone lines in about 20 minutes, and the number to dial is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email or text us now at cityvisions@kalw, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, Hadar Avaram, I wanted to start with you. We talk about this issue quite a bit these days, but let's remind ourselves how we got here in the first place.
That depends on who you ask. It's a story that you can tell in many different ways. One way to talk about it, which is relevant to what we're doing today, is that it starts with a bipartisan movement, very similar to the one that we have now. In the 50s and 60s, the United States had an indeterminate sentencing structure by which the judge would typically sentence someone to a large range of punishment. So, for example, you would get anywhere between 3 to 20 years, and the body that would decide when you're coming out would be the parole board. So the power was with the judges and with the parole board. This system encountered various difficulties, and it led to this push, this bipartisan push in the 70s to change the system and move toward a system that's more uniform. Conservatives thought that the prospect of releasing people early was coddling offenders. We weren't really rehabilitating people. Research had come out to show that whatever rehabilitation programs were happening in prison at the time was not working. Recidivism was not going down. And progressives at the time commented on the fact that this system led to arbitrary sentencing, where folks of color and folks of low income were serving longer sentences. Couple that with the rise of Nixon, the rise of conservatism, backlash against some decisions by the Warren Court, and a factor that my economist friends always remind me of, an increase in county prosecutors nationwide just charging people with more felonies. This leads to reforming the sentencing system in the United States, turning it into a determinate sentencing system where you get a given amount of time in prison and you usually serve most to all of it behind bars. The judges lose power, parole boards lose power, and power shifts to the hands of the prosecutors and to the hands of legislatures and citizen groups pushing voter initiatives, as is the case in California.
So, wow, that's a lot outlined all in your book, right? But so let's break it down. So then what does this actually mean? Like, how does the landscape then change?
So a number of things happen. One of them is that we just have a huge bunch of people coming in being charged with felonies, more people getting charged than before. And this does not necessarily parallel any rise in crime rates. The tendency is to think that crime rates were rising like crazy between the 60s and the 80s. Apparently, that is not true. As my friend Steve Raphael from Berkeley reminds me, data from the FBI was not complete at the time, so we actually don't know what the crime rates were like in the 60s and 70s, but there was this perception that there were dangerous people, so more people get charged with felonies. This means that the people that are charged and convicted are serving longer sentences. Now, here's the money aspect of all this. The feds are funding police departments. They're pushing money into urban police departments. This is partly why many of the listeners probably saw on TV the things that we saw in Ferguson, the military equipment and military techniques. This is all sort of the offspring of that Nixon-era push of money into police departments, but the feds didn't really fund state prisons. The states had to do that on their own. And that's how we came up with developing all kinds of obscure financial instruments to fund prisons without the voters actually noticing what they're paying for. We had to build a lot of prisons to house people, and prisons are a little bit like roads. The more roads you have, the more congestion you have, because there's more vehicles on the roads, and the more prisons we had, the more people were coming in, and this is how we come to a situation where we have A, lots of people coming in, B, people staying for longer sentences than they did before, which means they're getting older and caring for them becomes more expensive, and C, we're seeing not a lot of relief in terms of sentencing disparities. We're still seeing folks from disadvantaged communities disproportionately behind bars.
And say something more about why that didn't get better with the change in this attempt to not make the sentencing so arbitrary, as it were.
Well, part of what happens is that when you try to push things or change things around in terms of penal policy, these things tend to sneak in through the back door. So we've had a series of legislation efforts that were presumably, if you look at them, they appear to be race neutral, but actually they are geared more toward populations of color and populations of low income. The example that's probably going to be familiar to a lot of listeners is the crack cocaine disparity. But you're also seeing the police disproportionately spending more time in local communities. You're seeing the police spending more time on street crime than they are on other types of crime, again, without any proportion to how we know that these crimes are actually committed. We know that crimes are distributed a lot more evenly than who actually gets caught in the net of the criminal process.
So with that background, Matt Haney, I wanted to turn to what Cut 50 sees as the key issues that need to be addressed and how to address them.
Sure. Well, there are no shortages. You just heard of things that need to be addressed. I think the entire system, as you laid out, one that incarcerates over 2 million people still and has not started to move back despite all of the sort of change in dialogue and rhetoric and politics that we've seen. We haven't seen a big change in terms of the number of people who are incarcerated. And the United States continues to be, for many of the structural reasons that you just heard, the world's greatest incarcerator. And certainly as Cut 50, we believe that cutting the prison population, prison and jail population over 10 years really should be just the beginning. I mean, from what we have in our system, if we were to cut our prison population in half, we still would have close to, if not the most, people incarcerated of any country in the world, and certainly among the highest rates. And so I think our challenge as a country is to create a system that actually gets results, that actually is intended to help people turn their lives around, to find redemption, to find the support that they need to reintegrate into society, and is not instead just stacking years on top of years in an arbitrary, often politically determined fashion. So how did we get the sentences? How do we have the system that we have now? Well, politicians, often driven by fear, driven by, again, both parties, as we heard, a bipartisan movement, decided that there was a politically advantageous reason to campaign on tough on crime, and disconnected from the actual interests of public safety, put longer and longer sentences for more and more new crimes. And so that's where we got now, and that's what we have now. And if we want to get to something that actually has some degree of sanity and actually doesn't have the level of devastation on communities, especially on communities of color, the economic cost, the human cost, we need to start to unravel that. And we actually need to look at what would it take, when someone does find themselves in our justice system, often at a very young age to begin with, how do we actually provide them with the support, the resources, the reentry, rehabilitation, certainly in the case of drug or alcohol challenges or mental illness, that we actually have the response that meets the situation that they've brought forward, as opposed to punishment, what often makes things worse. So that's what we're working for with Cut 50, and for a range of reasons that I can talk about, we actually believe that we have a political moment right now where some of this is actually possible. We have right now, possibly for the greatest opportunity, at least in my lifetime, to actually build this sort of system that I'm talking about, that there's a real conversation about moving in a totally different direction, and there's wide agreement across the American public, across different ideology, geography, political party, age, race, and that we're seeing that even filter up to political leadership speaking that language. And so there's a real opportunity to change things right now. It's just a question of whether we take advantage of it.
So in the setting that we keep talking about of politics that is broken in Washington and in other parts of the nation, why is this moment, like, why is this moment come, has it come to be?
I think there's a number of things. You know, one is just the scale of mass incarceration in America has reached most people in this country in some way. Most of us have a friend, a family member, maybe ourselves have been caught up in the system and seen the way that it's failed those around us. There are roughly 80 million people in this country who have a criminal record of some kind. There's a huge, huge reach of this system that I think people have been able to see it firsthand, its failure. The other piece of it is, and this has been talked about a lot, the cost of it. It is incredibly expensive to lock people up, and we get very little for it. If this was a business, it would be shut down. It would fail. They would, you know, this is something that has such a high level of failure in terms of results. When you measure that against how much we're spending on it, even politicians are beginning to say, hold on a second, there's better ways to spend our money. And so you're seeing governments want to pull back, especially when the recession hit, which I'm sure we'll talk about. Politicians and governments are beginning to make choices about where they should put their money. And when they put their money in other things, they've seen not only have they been able to reduce overall spending, but they've actually not hurt public safety. It hasn't hit public safety, which was a surprise to a lot of people, and actually had better results. So the more that's happened, the more there's been, I think, a move towards alternatives, because people have seen that alternatives are not just cheaper, they actually work better.
Does everyone see, Hadar, does everyone see it the same way? I mean, or is it, the end point is reduce incarceration, but does everyone see the reasons for it the same way?
So I absolutely agree with Matt that this is an important moment. I think I see the moment a little bit differently. I wish that I could say that people have become more compassionate and more aware of what's going on. I think that incarceration is not distributed evenly across the population, so there are still people that are not feeling it morally, but I think that we've all come to feel it financially since the financial crisis of 2008. In Cheap on Crime, I talk about the fact that this led to the development of this new conversation about criminal justice that breaks through the usual impasses where the public safety people are talking about how dangerous it is to have dangerous criminals on the street, and the human rights people are saying, this is terrible. And instead, we all talk about something that as Americans we all sincerely love and believe in, which is money, and how we can try and save it. And this has been, I think, the catalyst for many of the successes that we've seen now breaking through after 40 years of impasse. One classic example is the legalization of marijuana, which has been almost purely run on a financial basis. A, why are we spending money on these people when we should spend money incarcerating the real criminals? We'll talk about who real criminals are, I hope, later, and if there is such a thing. And the other one is, this is a luxury item that we can tax and that can bring in revenue. So this is one way in which the conversation is shaped to bring in people who before couldn't really afford to speak publicly in ways that would be perceived as soft on crime.
But you're talking about conservatives here mostly, right?
I'm talking about both conservatives and liberals, because I think that pre the financial crisis, you couldn't even find a Democrat politician comfortable talking about being soft on crime. This is something that wouldn't really help you regardless of your political affiliation. And I think in the aftermath of the crisis, we're seeing politicians of all stripes feeling more comfortable doing this. Newt Gingrich is talking about reducing incarceration and ending the war on drugs. Kamala Harris, who is running for state senate, ran for attorney general on a platform that she called Smart on Crime, again, playing on this sort of cost theme. And even radical prison abolition organizations like CURB, Citizens United for a Responsible Budget, sorry, Californians United for a Responsible Budget, are packaging the message in a way that might appeal to a bipartisan audience.
I want to jump in, if I can, Joseph, and echo some of what Matt and Hadar have said. Historically, criminal justice policies have been a one-way ratchet. Regardless of which party controls the presidency or the governor's mansion or the legislature, the policies simply get more and more severe. And as Matt says, we are in a very unique moment right now. We're in a very unique moment where, for many of the reasons that Hadar has articulated, people across the political spectrum have recognized the urgent need for real, profound change. Now, that recognition is an important first step. But what has yet to come are policy changes. And if we are to accomplish the goals of Cut 50, if we are to begin making the kinds of reductions in our bloated prison and jail populations, there's really only three ways to do it. One, send less people to jail and prison. Two, the people who we do send must be sent for shorter periods of time. And third, we need to let people out sooner than they would otherwise get out under the current antiquated sentencing regimes.
You basically outlined the rest of the show here.
Oh, good.
Because that's exactly what I wanted to get to, which is how do you look at each of those pieces, pre-incarceration, at the time of trial and sentencing, you know, deciding who goes to trial in the first place, and then how are they sentenced, and then how long are they sentenced for, and then what happens to them after they're released?
Well, I have a lot to say about that. I'm glad we have a full hour. let me start with the first part, and I want to give some details about how we do it here in San Francisco. In many ways, it's representative of the rest of the state and country, and in many ways that hopefully will shock and offend the listeners, San Francisco is lagging far behind even other California counties. So jail is the form of detention that is most commonly employed pre-trial. Now, in some cases, some significant percentage of cases, especially for misdemeanors and less serious felonies, people will serve their sentence post-conviction also in county jail. State prison, traditionally, is where people sentenced on a felony conviction spend the rest of their term of incarceration. That's changed a little bit in the past few years under realignment in ways that we can explore. But for the moment, let's think about jail as the place where people serve less serious sentences or await their trials. In San Francisco, on any given day, there's approximately 1,200 people in county jail. 86% of them are still waiting for trial. In other words, they have not been convicted of a crime. They're awaiting trial or in the process of negotiating a plea. That percentage, 86%, again, it varies day to day, but that estimate percentage is the highest in California. It's one of the highest in the nation. Why is that? Why is it that in San Francisco, our judges and our prosecutors choose to insist on high bail amounts, to require that only the wealthy can be released, and that the poor, even though they're legally presumed innocent, must wait in custody for months and sometimes years while they develop a defense, negotiate a resolution to their case, or build the evidence they need to go to trial and prove their innocence.
So this is just one example, I imagine, of others that you will speak to about how San Francisco doesn't necessarily lead the country when it comes to criminal justice reform. But we'll take a momentary break to reintroduce the program in case you're just joining us. This is City Visions on local public radio 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at KLW.org. I'm Joseph Pache, and tonight we're discussing criminal justice reform with our guests Matt Haney, Director of Policy at Cut 50, Hadar Avaram, Professor of Law at UC Hastings, And right there, we were hearing from Chesa Boudin, and he is Deputy Public Defender with the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. We open our phone lines now to you, our listeners, to join this conversation. What do you think the U.S., California, San Francisco should do to address prison reform? How can we successfully reintegrate the men and women who have been incarcerated in the United States, and how can we turn our policies around? The number to dial to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@KALW, post a comment at the KALW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. So, Chesa, let's stay with you so we can kind of hear a little bit more about where how San Francisco stands out in ways that perhaps are not, we might not be proud of.
Sure. So another big part of the problem, and this touches back to what Hadar mentioned, the historic shift of power from judges to in the legislature to in parole boards, to prosecutors. And what we see in San Francisco, and it's not unique to San Francisco, but it's something that I see every day in my practice, in my legal practice here, is what we call overcharging. And because prosecutors have so much power, because judges no longer have discretion when it comes to sentencing, the sentencing range for a given criminal offense is pretty narrowly circumscribed. And so what that means is the decision about what specific penal code violation to charge in a given case, a prosecutorial decision, determines in large part the outcome of the case. It dramatically shapes the stakes for a defendant to exercise their right to go to trial, to maintain their innocence. It dramatically shapes and limits the range of sentencing options available to a judge. And what we see is in many cases that could be charged, for example, as a petty theft, instead prosecutors bring felony charges. Or in cases that could be charged as a simple run-of-the-mill felony, prosecutors instead charge it as a strike. And what that means is for the defendant facing those charges, the stakes of going to trial, of maintaining your innocence, of exercising your rights, your basic fundamental constitutional rights, become often far too high. And the incentive to plead guilty, to resolve a criminal case,
to a lesser charge.
Exactly. In other words, if you're a prosecutor and you want to save yourself the work of going to trial and risking a loss, save yourself the work of bringing in police officers and witnesses and actually proving your case, well, it's very easy. You simply charge the person with a much more serious offense than what they've actually committed, and then you offer to resolve it for a quote-unquote deal for an offense closer to what you think they actually did. And if you're the person who stands accused, you know that you've been overcharged, you know that what you've been charged with is an outrage, that you're innocent of that crime, but the stakes of risking a potentially long prison sentence and maybe a strike on your record are simply too high to bear.
So, Hadar, you wanted to respond there. I also wanted to ask you this question. This makes me think of that whole traffic example that you mentioned, that people have to do these workarounds to manage the high caseload and in some cases this perverse incentive to overcharge people.
So there's one more piece to this puzzle that I want to add, and I think that elaborates a little bit more on how diabolical the system is, and that is that the prosecutors can only play with the stuff that they have available. And legislatures nationwide have provided them with massively draconian criminal laws that attach sentences to offenses that are patently absurd. Which is why if you threaten someone with a third strike that could land somebody in prison for 25 to life for things that are not serious offenses and don't call for people spending time when they're old and sick behind bars, this is a huge incentive for people to plead guilty. One of the most deceptive things about this is that when people see trials on TV, police procedurals, all you see is trials. You don't realize that the system doesn't really work as a trial system. It works for the most part as a plea bargain system because prosecutors have available these truly frightening tools that would scare people away. So there's kind of like, I would think about it as sort of a two-track parade of horribles, right? There's the really horrific stuff that happens when someone gets sentenced to 25 to life for something that's not serious or for another horrible offense. And then there's the everyday little horrors of all the people who plead guilty to avoid that fate. And both of those things come from the same place.
So again, back to you, Matt. How do you get this type of very intricate analysis out there into the public's mind to help gain support for what you're trying to do.
It's interesting. You know, the legislature has actually trailed the public's views on this for some time, and I love the point that it does take place on a daily basis in the courtroom, but they're playing with the laws that the legislature has written that is so backwards, right? So we need to get to a point where we start to roll back some of those laws. And I think that we, and you mentioned this in the intro, that we did that with Prop 47, but we didn't do it through the legislative process because for all the times that that law was attempted, and actually a scaled back version to be passed in the California State Legislature, which would have actually just turned some of those crimes which were previously felonies into wobblers, which means they could be charged as a felony or a misdemeanor, that law couldn't get passed. And so instead they had to go to the ballot, and the public passed Prop 47 overwhelmingly, which took these felonies and turned them to misdemeanors, not even to wobblers. So this was an example, I think, of how we have to demonstrate both that we can change the laws, and then when we change the laws, that all hell doesn't break loose, right? Since Prop 47 has passed, there have been a number of studies that have shown that it has no negative effect on public safety, and has had huge positive effect on the number of people who are in prison, certainly, and it shows that we can make these changes and we can do them successfully. There's a lot of work to make things like Prop 47 effective and make sure people who are not going to prison are actually getting the support they need, and there's a lot there. But all over the country now, you're looking at both opportunities for state initiatives like Prop 47 and similar legislative efforts where we can demonstrate that we can unravel this. There is a way forward, and maybe we'll start with the what we would sort of look at as the low-hanging fruit, like the question of drug possession. But hopefully in California, we're already seeing that. We're going to work up from there. There are efforts in California to also unravel some of the sentencing enhancements that are really draconian around that are more around drug dealing, but that lead to these very long sentences. And I'm sure that Chesa can speak to what that looks like in the courtroom. But what we want to do is start at these very long sentences for these very, very low level offenses. But then we need to work up as we show that we can make this effective and that people can see the results of it, because this is a new way of operating. As we heard, for so long we've only gone in one direction. Now we're asking people to take a step with us in another direction. It's going to be maybe a baby step at first, but over time people are going to see that actually this is a not just a better way for a society to function. It's going to save us money, but it's going to protect our public safety better as well, which I think it still continues to be a fundamental concern.
So, yeah, I did want to talk a little bit about what we've seen from Prop 47 and realignment. What's your experience, Chesa?
Well, I think I agree with what Matt said. I think the way he characterized it is accurate. It's on point. And the reality is that many of the criminal codes are antiquated and out of date. And so some of them, for example, the ones that govern most theft crimes, the difference between a felony and a misdemeanor is determined by the dollar amount of the property stolen. And that's a logical enough way to approach dividing crimes into categories, the severity of the crime. We live in a property-based society, after all. But those dollar values hadn't been updated for years. And so one of the things that Prop 47 did is it increased the dollar value that can be stolen in, a shoplifting case, up to $950, so that now a broader group of shoplifting offenses, perhaps someone stealing the exact same items that they had stolen 10 or 15 years ago, but because of inflation and increasing prices, those charges had gone from misdemeanors to felony for the same exact conduct. So one of the things Prop 47 did is say, actually, anything $950 or less is still a misdemeanor.
And so what have you seen in terms of cases coming your way just because of this shift?
Well, it has shifted the nature of the caseload in the sense that a couple years ago, for example, an iPhone theft would have been a felony. And now most iPhone thefts are misdemeanors. So you do see shifts like that in terms of the specific kinds of offenses. But the most important thing to remember, as Matt says, is that these policy reforms have not in any way decreased public safety. In fact, I would argue quite the contrary, because keeping people in custody, in jail or prison, any longer than necessary is in and of itself criminogenic. In other words, it, and there's ample research to support this, but keeping people in custody who don't need to be there makes it more likely that those people will commit a criminal offense in the future. And the reasons are obvious. You don't need to read peer-reviewed research to understand why this is the case. When you take somebody away from their family, away from their community, away from their job, and whatever else they have that's rooting them in society, and you put them in custody, surrounded by other people accused of committing crimes, you destroy any chance they have of gainful employment. You destroy any chance they have of stability of housing, of breaking through drug addiction, or of addressing mental illness. It's a recipe for disaster. It's one that actually increases crime rather than decreases it. And the thing to remember as well when we think about prisons and longer-term incarceration in the order of magnitude that Hadar was referencing, 10, 20, 30 years, the overwhelming majority of people sent to prison will come home. So the question as a society we have to answer is, when people come home, what kind of people do we want to welcome? What kinds of skills? What kinds of resources?
This is City Visions on 91.7 KLW San Francisco and on the web at klw.org. I'm Joseph Pache. And tonight we're discussing criminal justice reform with our guests, Matt Haney, Director of Policy at Cut 50, Hadar Avaram, Professor of Law at UC Hastings, and Chesa Boudin, Deputy Public Defender at the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. We have a couple of phone lines open. We invite you, our listener, to join our conversation. 415-841-4134 is the number to dial. 415-841-4134. You can email us at cityvisions@klw.org, post a comment at the KLW website, or tweet us at cityvisionsKALW. Let's go to Starchild from San Francisco. Welcome to the program.
Hi. Thanks so much for taking the call. I'm glad that you guys are covering this, because I think pretrial detention is one of the biggest, most unconscionable abuses going on in the criminal justice system in the United States, perhaps in the United States generally. I think that people really need to draw a line in the sand and stop voting for the local politicians who allow this to happen, Republicans and Democrats, mainly Democrats in, you know, big cities like San Francisco. I'm an activist with the Libertarian Party. We stand wholeheartedly against this practice. We always believe in the right of innocence until proven guilty. And people who want to support us or get in touch can go to lpsf.org. There's also some people on the left, you know, who take this position. Former Sheriff Ross Mercurini, I personally lobbied him about this issue, and he indicated he was going to try to do more. He'd already taken something to the Board of Supervisors, but they rejected it to try to get more people into diversion. But by and large, most of the politicians don't care, because the people continue to be electing them year after year. Even people like Nancy Pelosi, who never debate her opponents. You know, since she got elected the first time to Congress, she's never debated even her Republican opponents, let alone her alternative party opponents. They don't feel accountable. The media doesn't hold them accountable when they don't debate, when they don't acknowledge issues like this, when they allow abuses like pretrial detention to continue.
All right. Well, thank you so much, Starchild, for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah. Go ahead, Hadar.
So with regard to pretrial detention, one important thing to remember is that when we look at that, the problems with pretrial detention are similar to other problems in criminal justice in the sense that they don't really address the realities of risk. They address more of a facade of what they think sells as risk, which is to say, when judges assign monetary bail to people, the bail doesn't really correlate in any way with any known risk, whether the person's going to flee or reoffend. The judges know, the same way as the suspects know, that if the family has that choice, they're going to go to a bail bondsman, and the bail bonds industry is pretty much what drives the whole monetary bail industry. They're going to go, they're going to bail, they're going to pay the bail bondsman something like 10% of the overall bail amount. And then they basically transfer the risk over to this private actor that doesn't care one way or another whether the person's going to show up, because all they want is the 10%. So we're not really calibrating the amount of money. Arguably, we shouldn't be doing monetary bail at all. We should be thinking about other creative solutions of what to do with people pre-trial. But we're calibrating the money not so much to whether we really think that this person's going to reoffend, but to this bail protocol that basically lists amounts of money for offenses technically, knowing that a private actor that doesn't care and doesn't have interest one way or the other is going to assume the risk.
I'm curious, what are some of those alternatives for pretrial?
So people have made all kinds of recommendations. One thing that the Pretrial Justice Institute is recommending is the introduction of software that predicts risk, but that has its own can of worms that we can talk about a little bit later, and that has its own problems. But for example, we can think about solutions of releasing people under conditions, releasing people to the custody of family members and friends that can take care of them. This is what historically bail was like. People would only be detained in the rare situations where you really couldn't guarantee that the person wasn't going to flee or reoffend. And instead, it's become the norm that people can't afford to pay the bail bondsman and they stay locked up. And by the way, I probably need to say this. We're talking a lot about money and about costs and about the overall scale of the system. And it's sometimes easy to forget that spending time in an overcrowded jail or prison is basically a human rights crime. The conditions in many jails in California and elsewhere in the nation are terrible. You know, when we did realignment and we started moving people out of state prisons because the health care we were providing wasn't really health care and people were dying needlessly from neglect, we were moving them into jails. Part of the mentality was, well, it can't possibly be worse in county jails. Well, guess what? It can be worse. You go to a place like the Los Angeles County Jail, it's a horrific situation to hold human beings in. And that has, as Chesa explained earlier, lots of effects on criminality. It has effects on people's health, you know, which obviously drives up costs of incarceration, and on a variety of other negative things that later stay with us.
And I want to tie Hadar's point. I echo what she said about the conditions in jails and prisons, but I want to tie it back also to this broader concept of criminal justice. When you tie custody status to wealth, the way that we do with our monetary bail system, you dramatically undermine the legitimacy of the entire criminal justice system. And I want to explain briefly why that is. As it currently works, as Hadar was explaining, let's take two people, both arrested for the same crime, let's say a robbery. They both go to court. They're both arraigned on charges of robbery. The judge sets a dollar amount for bail. Let's pick a number. Let's say the judge determines that $50,000 is the appropriate amount of bail for both of these two similarly situated, similarly charged people. One of them has $5,000 in the bank. Their family takes that money to a bail bondsman. They're released from custody the next day. The other one is too poor to come up with that $5,000. They sit in custody until they go to trial months later, or until they plead guilty to get out of jail. When you have custody status determined by wealth and wealth alone, you undermine the veracity of the criminal justice outcomes because people plead guilty to get out. This goes back again to the point made earlier about the tremendous power prosecutors have. They know that if they say to somebody who is risking losing custody of their kids, risking losing an apartment in San Francisco or a job that they fought long and hard to win, if they say to that person, plead guilty and get out today, what would you do even if you're innocent, if you're risking losing custody of your kids? But that choice, that horrific, coercive choice, is one that only the poor confront. Because our money bail system ensures that the rich, no matter how heinous the crimes they're accused of, no matter how many prior offenses they may have committed, it ensures that the rich can get out of jail the next day, and the poor stay in and face that choice. Plead guilty to something you may not have done so that you can get out, or stay in jail for months or longer while you maintain your innocence.
So we spent a lot of time talking about the pre-trial period. Let's move to talking about sentencing. What is Cut 50's approach to this? What kinds of policy would they like to see?
So we've spent a lot of time working on some of the federal legislation that you mentioned in the beginning, which I will say, unfortunately, will not get us anywhere near cutting 50. This is one of those steps forward in the right direction that I think that we need and that we have an opportunity to take right now. you know, the federal system has about half of its people who are incarcerated in the federal system are there for drug offenses, nonviolent offenses. It's really has been in many ways the forefront of the failed, you know, I don't even say failed because maybe it accomplished what it set out to do, but the war on drugs, where we were literally stacking on incredibly long mandatory minimum sentences, sometimes for crack, sometimes for other drugs. And the federal system has really continued to reflect that reality. Overwhelmingly, people of color who are in there for long amounts of times, long mandatory sentences. And the reality is that these mandatory sentences, for all the studies that have been done, and sometimes you don't even need studies, as Jesse said, have shown that they don't protect public safety. They're unnecessary. In fact, they sometimes backfire and create more problems than they solve. So one of the things that we need to do right away is roll back these mandatory minimums. You know, we would like to see in Cut 50 us get rid of mandatory minimums altogether, get back to a situation where judges can actually judge and determine the right punishment or even the right response. You don't have to think about it in terms of punishment. In many cases, what people need is treatment. In many cases, what people need is a job, or what they need is a treatment for their mental illness. But in any case, what they almost always do not need is 15, 20, 25 years in prison for a nonviolent drug crime, which is what we have a huge number of people still being sentenced to in the federal prison. And in federal prison, I will say that Cut 50 is also pushing for the president to use his power of clemency with a lot more seriousness and a lot more broadly. If in reality, as he said, we should not have people serving decades for drug crimes, he actually has the power right now today to commute.
But he's not been using it.
And he has been using it, but he's been using it in very small amounts. And in 2 years ago, the Attorney General, Eric Holder at the time, came out and said that they would like to see people who are serving at least – have served at least 10 years in prison for a nonviolent crime in the federal system apply for clemency. At the time, he said that he thought that this could be up to 10,000 people. There's actually many more than 10,000 people who would qualify under that. Since that time, the president has granted, I think the number is 360, roughly, commutations. There are many, many more to go. And
how does that compare to his Republican predecessors, though?
So he has commuted more sentences, I think, than the last four or more, 10 presidents combined. He's used the commutation power more so than past presidents. But in reality, you know, he has an opportunity to actually correct the past. You know, he has identified that this and the American people have identified that this war on drugs has not worked, that it's actually done more harm than good. And so I think people are calling on him to do more to actually reverse it. There is a precedent for much more broad use of the clemency power. President Ford, shortly after the Vietnam War, gave mass clemency for people who had been convicted of crimes related to dodging the draft. You know, we think that the president should use a similar type of approach to really bring about true justice for people who are really have been victimized. You know, I think we need to see people who received, again, life sentences for drug crimes, that they are victims, that they're separated from their families, and that they deserve to have redress as well.
So, Hadar, I feel like I stepped over a piece here, which is before even people go to trial, what about diversion, pre-trial diversion? What kinds of reforms need to happen in that area?
So I'm happy to talk about that, but I just want to make two short comments to address some of the things that Matt has told us about. One of them is that the president can do real magic, but the magic is limited to the federal system. And the vast majority of inmates in the United States are doing time in state and local institutions that the president has some, you know, symbolic inspiration power over, but he can't actually change the systems in the state that house around 86% of the prisoners in the United States. So that's one thing to keep in mind. You know, it's good to have inspiring things happen, but it's also better to have them happen on the ground. The other concern that I have about a lot of the bipartisan things that we've done that I think are great and marvelous and we're making a lot of progress, but they tend to address, I think for obvious reasons, nonviolent inmates. This relates to your point about diversion. Many of the efforts that we've made, both with realignment and with Prop 47 and with other programs that were supposed to take people out of prison and do other things, things with them have been marketed to the public as addressing specifically nonviolent criminals. Now, this it relies on the assumption that is scientifically not true, that these are folks that are less likely to recidivate and are less dangerous, and that people who have committed violent offenses are this, you know, indistinguishable block of dangerous people that we're not even touching.
And irredeemable in some way.
Irredeemable in some way. And by making all this effort with nonviolent criminals and constantly marketing our propositions as addressing nonviolent inmates, my concern is that we're in some way, and maybe it's unavoidable because we're working in a political system where we have to have partners, and I think Cut 50 has been fantastic in actually bringing to the table conservative think tanks and people like the Koch brothers and Right on Crime and all those folks. But my concern is that the bipartisan coalition is fragile when it comes to talking about violent inmates and when it comes to saying, hey, not everybody who commits a violent offense is going to commit another violent offense. Many violent offenses are things that you do once in a lifetime. You repent for the rest of your life, and you never do anything illegal again.
Is it a matter of incrementalism? Will you start with nonviolent offenders, get people to kind of buy into that, and then you move on? Or do you really feel like there's going to be this firewall between the,
Possibly. And I think a lot of this depends on the marketing, right? I mean, part of this is, and I think this is, given the fact that the way to move forward and make proposals that are palatable to the public is to talk about nonviolent offenders, because this is something that the public can relate to, I think there's almost no choice but to do that. But I think we should start plotting what the next step is going to look like so that it's really incremental, and so that when we come to the point where we're saying, well, what really is the difference between someone who committed a nonviolent offense and someone who committed a non-serious assault that they deeply repent? What is the difference in terms of danger?
Chesa, why don't you go ahead, and then Matt, and then we have a few calls to get to.
Well, I want to emphasize the importance of what Hadar just pointed out. I think Matt and the Cut 50 movement and many of the people talking about this work are very focused on, and rightly so to some degree, on nonviolent drug offenses, for example. It's something that you hear people talk about all the time. There's absolutely no reason to have people incarcerated for decades for drug offenses, for things that are nonviolent, that are really medical public health problems rather than criminal problems. So I think Matt's absolutely right that the president can and should do much more. Hopefully he will. And that governors at every state level, as Hadar points out, should be doing the same thing across the country. But to Hadar's point, as much as we can do to reduce the prison population through nonviolent drug offenses, property crimes, et cetera, the reality is that if we don't take a hard look in the mirror and also confront the problem of violent offenses, we will never solve the problem of over-incarceration, of mass incarceration in this country. The reality is that people who commit crimes, however petty, driven by mental illness or drug addiction, are likely to continue doing so. Some percentage of them will recidivate, inevitably. And so if we take it incrementally and say, well, we're going to reduce the number of people incarcerated for these low-level offenses and see what that does for public safety, we may be disappointed with the results. The reality, as Hadar points out, is that the most violent offenders, in many cases, are the least likely to recidivate. People who commit a murder in the heat of passion are very, very unlikely to ever go back to prison, especially after 10, 15, 20 years. And yet, in the United States and in nowhere else in the developed world, those people face many, many more decades, even after there's absolutely no associated public safety benefit from their continued incarceration.
So, Matt, then how do you sequence this conversation? Mm-hmm. Are you ready to start pushing people on mm-hmm. on sentencing reform for violent offenders?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. I mean, I think what we'd want to see is an unraveling of this system that we're talking about that is disconnected from public safety, and indeed it's disconnected from responses that are actually trying to address the underlying issue that is being brought into the system by an individual's experience. So in reality, what we need is more empathy. We need to begin to have people identify if they can start by identifying with somebody who got in there because of a drug problem, fine. But then they start to see how this system often makes things worse, and how you go into a facility, as Chesa talked about, and it ends up not actually addressing the underlying challenge that you had, and you come out a lot worse. That's as true for a nonviolent offense as it is for a violent offense. And so people begin to be able to see that connection and have that empathy. So ultimately, I think this is the beginning. If this is a first step, and indeed, it's in many ways some of the most egregious situation.
I mean, so do you feel
something
like
that we should be able to change tomorrow? But again, the conversation has to continue.
So do you feel like the coalition that Hadar labels as fragile, perhaps is it up to the going there now? Do you feel like the time to strike, so to speak, on violent reforming how we treat violent offenders is also part of this moment that you're talking about?
I think that the coalition is fragile for a lot of reasons, and this is one of them. I'd say the bigger issue is just the brokenness of our politics and the sort of the way in which people go into their corners and all of that. But in reality, you know, we should go as far as we possibly can, wherever we can. An example of this is there's no reason why we can't have this conversation about both violent offenses and nonviolent offenses here in San Francisco. It isn't a bipartisan coalition that's preventing us from doing that, but still yet we're continuing to face those same challenges. So it's not just the bipartisan question that's preventing us from doing it. As we have both said, Democrats also have been part of this problem. And even here in liberal progressive San Francisco, we haven't been able to get to that. So let's start to go as far as we can, wherever we can.
I just want to push one more thing here. It was actually a call from someone who couldn't stand the line. Eric from Redwood City wanted to know about decriminalizing drugs. How much would that help solve this problem? And number two, could the people out there, politicians, the public, really, are they ready for that?
Well, I mean, let me just say from my own personal experience here in San Francisco, where we think of ourselves, as Matt says, as being very liberal, cutting edge, progressive around issues. Let's just talk about marijuana, for example. I currently, in my caseload, have approximately 15% of my cases are marijuana sales cases. Why are we wasting public resources prosecuting people who have prescriptions for marijuana and who are being accused of possession with intent to sell? That's what the district attorney's office is using its resources for. That's what the police are using their resources for. And that's part of what's clogging up the courts. It's a waste of time. It's a waste of resources. And you can guess what color the skin of the people prosecuted for these charges are in the overwhelming majority of the cases.
Anyone want to add to that?
Sure. So one of the things that's been interesting looking at legalization efforts in other states, the states that have already passed legalization initiatives for recreational marijuana, is public safety doesn't go down. You know, there's not a lot changes beyond the fact that the state gets additional revenue from the sales. But that really depends on a good job done by economists that price the drugs right to make it worthwhile for people to buy legally as opposed to buying in the street. It's not rocket science. Other states have managed to do it. I recently talked to economists in Colorado that were talking about how they successfully set the price point. It's something that we can do easily. It's something that I believe we're going to have a chance to do in 2016. I think that the previous time Californians had a chance to do this in 2010, we had a proposition that, because there were a lot of compromises involved, was a little bit chaotic. We're going to be seeing a legislative piece that is going to be more organized and something that makes it easier for people to get behind. And I would like to urge anybody who would like to increase the state budget to vote yes on whatever it is.
And is anyone looking at beyond marijuana here?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, look at – there's a lot of discussion right now about the opiate epidemic and prescription drug epidemic across the country. And if you look at the difference in the way that politicians and the criminal justice system treat people who are addicted to prescription opioids to the way that we treated the crack epidemic in the 1980s, it's night and day. And it's driven largely by class and race. And so I think we have a model for how to approach it. And we already have a country that's largely dependent on drugs of some kind or another: caffeine, sugar, tobacco, alcohol. We have existing models for how to deal with and incorporate drugs into our society. We do it every day. Why we've chosen to treat certain classes of drugs as these heinous criminal offenses rather than as something to be controlled, taxed, regulated, and treated as a medical problem is really one that I think gets at the heart of the role the criminal justice system plays in social control and oppression of poor and people of color.
So let's turn in the last 5 minutes of our program to talk about what actually happens while people are incarcerated and at the point of reentry. And we actually have a caller who's been waiting patiently for this moment. Christina, San Francisco, welcome to the program.
Hi. I just had an idea. You know, what if, you know, there were some kind of program, because the tech industry is so big, what if there was some kind of program that taught people while they were in jail or in prison to code and to build apps so that when they got out of jail, they would have the opportunity perhaps to join a tech company, to join a startup, and to get into this lucrative world of building apps.
Thank you.
Building web pages.
Thank you so much, Christina, for your call. So it sounds like perhaps that's already going on, isn't it?
So I have good news and bad news for Christina. The good news is that programs like this do exist. One of them is called The Last Mile, and it's a program run by Silicon Valley entrepreneurs that work with people in prison.
We had them here on the show previously.
Indeed, and they're fantastic. They do face a lot of serious challenges. One of them is the fact that inmates do not actually have access to computers and the internet, so everything is done with printed materials, which only gives you a little bit of a perspective on how difficult it is to put together a program like this. But people do get out and they get internships in places like this. The bad news is that when we started talking about cutting incarceration because of budgetary concerns, we've also been cutting rehabilitation programs and we've cut funds for reentry, which is sort of the dark side of this moment of opportunity. And one of the problems is that even though we can now point to specific programs that the California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation is doing that actually help reduce recidivism to close to zero, if not to completely zero, very few people get the benefit of actually taking those programs. The other thing that stands sort of that is a little bit of a hindrance.
Because they don't get scaled up or they get cut.
Exactly. Or because there's just a very limited number of programs offered. They're not offered in all the prisons. Folks that are doing time in San Quentin are luckier because where the state doesn't have money, people like us step in and volunteer and do these programs. But if you have the bad luck of being in Pelican Bay or in Susanville or somewhere else, it's less likely that you'll be able to benefit from the wealth of programs that are offered in places that are closer to cities.
But let's move, because we only have a couple more minutes, to policies, Matt, that you're looking for at the time of reentry so that people can really become reintegrated into society.
So there's a range of things. One is, and this gets talked about a lot, are the barriers that exist for people. You know, if you can't get housing, if you can't get a job, if you can't get benefits, it's very difficult for you to reenter successfully. So just first lift the barriers, I think, is a huge piece of what we need to do. And actually, voting is a part of that. I mean, if we want to have people come in and be full citizens again, which is what they deserve, they've served their time, they need to be able to vote. They need to be able to have everything that comes with that. Of course, there's also the other sort of more positive types of assistance that people need. Job training. That's, you know, your caller brought that up. In many cases, what people need is help securing a job. In other cases, what they need is treatment or supportive housing. There are programs that work. We know that they work. And unfortunately, as you heard, they are not viewed as an essential part of the system.
So is this where this economic push falls apart, is when you're hoping to save money, but then what you really need to do is redistribute that money into programs that keep people from reentering prison in the first place? Is this where it falls, where the coalition falls apart?
I don't think so. And I think that what we need to do is to retool the way we think about this away from thinking about it as savings toward thinking about it as a return on investment. You have to put money into the right places, and the right places are focusing on a good, solid reentry program in order to see the benefits.
And let me just add to that. I think to go back to Matt's point about empathy, Hadar's point about where we want to invest the resources, we want to invest smart on crime, as people like to say. In some of our communities, when we talk about public safety, when we talk about reentry, we have a vision of what it means to be a safe community, a vision that includes well-resourced schools, beautiful lawns, nice houses, high college acceptance rates. And in other communities, the vision of public safety is a police officer and surveillance cameras on every corner. And what we need to do is make sure that all of our communities have access to the same kind of vision of public safety and integration into the resources and opportunities that San Francisco offers its most privileged.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks for a very lively conversation. To my guests, Matt Haney, Director of Policy at Cut 50, Hadar Avaram, Professor of Law at UC Hastings, and Chesa Boudin, Deputy Public
public defender with the San Francisco Public Defender's Office. Thanks to all of you for joining me this evening.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page at KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Kendra Klang and our senior producer, Susie Britton. We'll be off next Monday for Memorial Day. Join co-host Ethan Elkind on June 6th for an Election Eve roundtable. This is Joseph Pache. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.